Hey, everybody. Welcome to the Bloody Awesome Movie Podcast. I'm John Burke, and with me, as always, is Matt Hudson from whatiwatchtonight.co.uk. Matt, how you doing, sir?
I'm doing very well, my friend. It's late night over here in the United Kingdom, and I feel like I'm ready to party like it's 1999. The Halcyon days, one of the best years in film. Even with The Phantom Menace coming out, I do enjoy The Phantom Menace. I'm a Star Wars head. Of course I do. Dude, I'm doing very well. I've got a cup of tea as per usual. It's nearing the end of the week. Hopefully we've got a good film to talk about tonight. We'll get to that. But no, I am pleased to report everything is well over here in the UK. I'm going to throw it right back at you like a quarterback throws a football to the receiver. How are you doing, my friend? You keeping Florida safe and well?
I'm fine. You know, it's Groundhog Day today when we're recording this. It's this week has felt very long, so much so that I had one coworker say this week feels like it's taking forever. And then a few minutes later, without hearing that, a different coworker walked by and was like, this week's taking forever. And I'm like, wow.
No, not now.
On Groundhog Day, I can't have repetition. It'll freak me out.
Did you see the announcement? I think it was in like Montreal or I think it was in Quebec, because they were speaking French. But the town came out. As we're recording on Groundhog Day, the town mayor came out to present the groundhog and do their usual celebrations. And they had to announce that the groundhog had died. The groundhog had passed away. So now people are kind of worrying, what does that mean? Is the world coming to an end because the groundhog's died?
Yeah, I did not see that. That is wild. I did see that in Punxsutawney, I believe they said he saw a shadow. But man, that's wild. I often will watch Groundhog Day on Groundhog Day. I probably won't tonight. But who knows? I might feel like I need a little bit of Bill Murray to soothe my soul.
Yes, sir.
We are talking 90s today, though. Matt kind of alluded to it because rarely we're talking about a VOD only release. This is not a streaming release. This is like you have to pay video on demand. We briefly talked about this last week in preparation for this episode, but we're going to be covering this week. Our main review is Millennium Bugs. And Millennium Bugs is directed by Alejandro Montoya Marin. And I have interviewed him on my old podcast, Burke Reviews Movie Club, technically top five movies back in the day. Same place where I met Matt all those years ago. Were probably within a few months of each other, to be honest.
It was. I remember you saying, I think we did ours first. And then I remember you saying you were speaking to Alejandro. And then after that, I was able to watch Monday because of that. So JB set me up with a film already in the early days. Good days they were.
Right. And I do think, I don't know if I probably use the word friend too liberally, but I do think of Alejandro as a friend. We're definitely acquaintances. Mm-hmm. We've spoken on many occasions. We interact on social media. He's talked to one of my classes. He let me show his first feature film Monday, to one of my classes. Then he did a Q&A with them over Skype. So,
very cool.
He's a super cool guy, loves movies and, I helped fund the Indiegogo for the movie we're covering tonight, Millennium Bugs, several years ago when he started the process. And I actually saw this movie a couple of years ago, and now that it's finally getting a wide release, we were asked if we would be willing to talk about it on the podcast. And this is full disclosure, the reviews, the opinions we're going to give are our genuine opinions. But do know that these are, you know, this is the circumstances in which this movie is being reviewed. The main reason why I said yes isn't because he's a person I consider to be a friend, isn't because I like the movie, but it's because I like to be a place where you can find movies that are worth seeing that you won't get marketed to the same way other films. This movie is not going to have the marketing budget to make sure you see it on billboards or to have a trailer in front of the big movie releases. The only way you're going to learn about this movie's existence is people like us. And I like to be that voice when I can. So I happily said yes. Was I grateful that it's also a movie that I have positive feelings for? Yeah, because it makes it a lot easier. This would be a very awkward podcast today if I was like, oh, this movie's kind of bad.
Thanks for putting the money in. It sucks.
Yeah,
I wasn't going to say no to JB or Alejandro in terms of getting this film on the pod. I was just sorry to interrupt, but I was just looking at when I got this. I got this sent to me on Wednesday, the 26th of August, 2020. It feels so, so long ago now. But here we are finally talking about it, dude.
Yep, and that is what we're going to get into. So let's do that. We said it's written and directed by Alejandro. The cast is a bunch of people that are very talented, although I don't know that you will have seen them in anything, but just in case, Katie Aaron is our lead. I'm going to forget character names off the top of my head, but I will pull those up.
Kelly.
Kelly. And, sorry, I'm switching back and forth between tabs, folks. Michael Lovato is Miguel. And then Micah McNeil, Sophia Embed, Jamie H. Jung, who is, I've also interviewed and been on my old podcast. Yes. And he started podcasting, much like Matt, because I introduced him to podcasting. And
goddamn like trailblazer.
Kenneth McLaughlin, who is both Jamie and Kenneth are the stars of Alejandro's first film, Monday. And so I was excited when to see them in this movie as well. They have smaller parts in this film than they did on Monday, but both are really talented. And I believe Monday was on Amazon for a minute. Mm-hmm. I really enjoy that movie a lot too. So if you like Millennium Bugs, I do recommend that you look for other work that Alejandro's done. He has a YouTube channel. He does a lot of short films. Some of them are very, very funny. Alejandro's got a real sense of humor. And this movie, Millennium Bugs, is set in the days leading up to the year 2000. So it's set in 1999, literally the last few days of the year. Kelly and Miguel, who are best friends, along with the rest of the world, find themselves facing mounting pressures and harsh realities of their futures. Usually, here's where we tell you what other people thought, but this is a relatively new wide release, and so there's no scores yet. We don't have a Rotten Tomatoes score, although it was fun looking at Rotten Tomatoes, and there's two reviews up there. Ours will be up there soon, but yes, two of them, I know one of them, Rosa Parra, is Latinx Lens. I follow her on social media. She's very friendly, has a lot of, I think, often similar opinions to me about movies. She mm-hmm. gave it the positive score on Rotten Tomatoes. So fresh. And then Alan NG, I don't know how to pronounce that, and I'm so sorry. I know I should know how to pronounce that, but I do not. But he's from Film Threat, also gives it the fresh rating. Both of those were from back in 2020. So, you know, the people who have been able to see this and give reviews have been positive. And we're going to talk about it now, since I can't tell you the other scores, but we're going to get into it. We're going to be contributing either positive or negative by the end of this review. So we'll see how that goes. But this should be available on iTunes. I believe February 7th is the date that I was told. So keep an eye out. It won't be on all VOD, but for sure it's on iTunes. I think it will be on a few other platforms. So check those and rent or buy Millennium Bugs. If you want to listen, I mean, after you hear our review, of course. Obviously, I wrote my review for this, so at BurkeReviews.com you can go and read my initial reaction to the film, and it hasn't changed. Alejandro has a really strong sense of the 90s. This movie did remind me of Clerks, which is a favorite of mine. In terms of like its commentary on they're talking about pop culture. There's a lot of pop culture references, which is something I really always click with because I obsess over pop culture. And I think Alejandro is very similar. That's mm-hmm. one of the reasons when I interviewed him, we clicked so well because we like a lot of the same stuff. We're both big movie nerds. He's just chose to make them. I choose to write about them instead.
Very well too.
And you know, but I thought Katie and Michael do a terrific job as Kelly and Miguel. I think my initial opinion of the two characters was I was not vibing with Miguel at first, but that's kind of the point. You're supposed mm-hmm. to kind of, he's a wet blanket at first and then he loosens up a little bit. Kelly's a bit too wild, and over the course we're expecting change. And I think the movie does a terrific job navigating these two characters, understanding the stresses of the time period, the uncertainty of everything, and how that kind of relates to the uncertainty of life, that life is a struggle. We don't know what's coming. We're always kind of fearing the worst, and sometimes the worst doesn't come, but that doesn't mean everything else is still okay, right? Like there's still things that we have to take care of. There's things that we have to deal with, and sometimes it's hard. That's part of the struggle. We use the phrase now, adulting, which was not a buzzword in 1999, but that's ultimately what this movie's kind of exploring, is how do we become adults, especially when we are in this civilization, in this culture, this world that these two characters find themselves in. And I think he does a terrific job exploring those things. These are flawed characters, but they're not so flawed that they're unlikable. And I think that's an important balance that some filmmakers struggle to find. How do you make a character have issues, to be troubled, to be flawed, and still be empathetic and still want them to succeed, want them to be able to figure it out? And I think Alejandro manages to do that with both characters in this movie. And I can't deny I'm partial to this setting. This is my senior year, 1999, and then 2000 I graduate. So I remember the Y2K phenomenon. I remember New Year's Eve, we're watching MTV's, you know, like New Year's Eve special. Limp Bizkit plays 1999, the Prince song on the thing. Like, I have vivid memories of this New Year's, more so than any other New Year's of my life, because there was so much anxiety about it. People were genuinely scared. I think my family even let me have champagne. I was only like 17, but they were just like, yeah, well, who knows? We may not be here in 20 minutes. And by champagne, like, we mean the cheap stuff, right? Like, I'm talking, it's probably sparkling wine, because based on the Wayne's World story.
Yes, sir.
I doubt it was from the Champagne region of France. Nevertheless, I think all of those things, along with, again, having very similar sensibilities to Alejandro, Millennium Bugs works for me tremendously. I do want people to get to see this movie. I think Alejandro represents this new age of filmmaker. It's similar. We, you know, Tarantino and Edgar Wright grew up on movies. We've grown up on Tarantino, Edgar Wright, and Kevin Smith, where it's a lot of referential stuff. It's, you know, loving pop culture and obsessing over it and relating back on how pop culture affects us and affects our kind of interpretation of reality. And seeing filmmakers that have that perspective getting to make movies, I think, is a big thing. And I'd love to have this movie find its audience, because I think when it does, it will become a cult classic. I think there's going to be a lot of love for this movie because it does have an audience. But I am interested, Matt, if you're one of those members of the audience, what did you think of Millennium Bugs?
I was a member of the audience who watched this film, John. I can confirm I've watched this for the show. I was very lucky to have received that link many moons ago, and to be able to rewatch it in 2023 is bonkers. But remember, we've had a pandemic in between that, which I believe actually halted the premiere of this film. Was it South by Southwest? I think it was. It
had to be put for Monday. Monday. Yes, okay. I'm sorry. I don't know for sure if there was supposed to be a festival release at South by for this or not. I do think it has had some festival runs. I'm just not sure which festivals.
I think it has done now, certainly. But I know COVID was COVID. But I do enjoy me a coming-of-age story, John. I do enjoy me a dramedy. I also enjoy a trip back to the 90s, which is why I enjoyed Millennium Bugs. Listeners to the show for the last 5 years know that, myself and John as well. But myself, I'll always happily be honest about a film if I don't like it. But that's not the case in this instance. It's not. I wouldn't say a film was very good because we were able to see it early, or John has an acquaintance with the director or writer. In the end of the day, if a film isn't great, a film's not great, I'm going to say it. However, in this instance, I had a good time with Millennium Bugs. It's very much up my alley in terms of the fact that we pretty much just follow these two characters. Like you mentioned, John, we follow Kelly and Miguel, Katie Aaron and Michael Lovato. And their chemistry works really well in this film, because if it doesn't, you really haven't got a hope in succeeding. And of course, they're the odd couple in a sense as well. You have Kelly, who's an alcoholic, essentially, who's getting over some past trauma, shall we say, and she's a bit more abrasive. And Miguel is, you know, he comes from a good family. He comes from a hardworking family. He's a hardworking dude, but he's a little bit more reserved in that sense. But they kind of bring out the best and worst in each other. It's a friendship. It feels like a friendship. You have a film here which deals with a platonic friendship, and it's excellent to see the two work well together. I must say, I was very impressed by Katie Aaron. I thought her performance felt very raw, very electric at times. I did enjoy Michael Lovato. Like you, I think he grew into the film the more meat he got on those bones. But I didn't have any issues with his performance whatsoever overall. I think the film looks good as well. Independent films have a license of freedom. They have that element of freedom that you don't also often get with a studio film. But sometimes that can also bring limitations. I know Monday was the $7,000 film. This was, I think, $50,000 the budget was. Mm-hmm. Sometimes you can look at that. Me specifically, you get indie films coming through sometimes, and sometimes they don't look great. sometimes you just have to be honest and say, yes, it doesn't look great. This one does. And I mean, this, I was really surprised when I was watching it, that the grading, the lighting, it looked very polished, looked very professional. Do not mean to sound condescending when I say that. I'm talking more about the budget here. This is an extremely low budget film, but it doesn't look like one. It doesn't play what like one. It doesn't feel like one. And you mentioned Edgar Wright. Oh, sorry, go on, sir.
No, I don't mean to interrupt you because I talked probably too long as it was, but I love that comment because I do agree with that completely. Like one of the things when I talked to Alejandro about his $7,000 movie,
yeah,
that he made Monday, that he made with the Rebel Without a Crew TV series and the help of Robert Rodriguez's show, that's which right. is so cool. I wish they would do it again because I think all of the filmmakers there got to learn something and they all got to make their features. And Alejandro, I talked to him about the process, and like he valued sound actually over the visual, but he's able to get like a really solid visual, even though he knows that sound is so important, and it can easily break the reality of a film even easier than a bad visual. Proof in point, look at stupid freaking, what the heck's that movie called that I don't like? Skinamarink. But that movie isn't really concerned about the quality of the image or the quality of the sound effects, if you ask me. But nevertheless, that to me, like, I can forgive a like fuzzy camera or something, because especially if you're shooting low light, which some of the scenes in this movie are shot in very low lighting.
Yes, they are. Yeah.
And it appears to be kind of like using the natural or ambient light in the space rather than like having an expensive lighting crew, because that, again, that increases your budget fast. And the score, the soundtrack for this movie definitely probably costs a good chunk of the budget, because there's some good music in this. It's not,
there's some good needle drops in there.
Yeah. It's not just original stuff and you have to pay licensing for all that. And Kevin Smith has even revealed sometimes you can really finagle and work some good deals with that. It all depends on the artist and their willingness to work with other artists.
Yeah.
But I would venture to say he put a lot into sound too. And those two things, it does not feel like a $50,000 movie. And that shouldn't be a derogatory. It has become one, but it's a throwback to those early Sundance indies though. When you get El Mariachi or Pulp Fiction, well, mm-hmm. Reservoir Dogs, sorry, more so than Pulp Fiction, Clerks, you know, where I think Clerks was 67,000 or something like that. It's a throwback to that, which is great because he sets it in the 90s. So it even has the vibe of those movies, but the whole process, I feel like he's walking in Rodriguez's shoes to a degree by doing the $7,000 movie and then doing this $50,000 movie. Mm-hmm. You're seeing these old school Sundance indie films. Cause now when we say indie films, we're like $5 million budgets, yeah, right?
Indie
like
that's films, not what it used to be, is it?
Yeah. It's such a broad term. Cause when we say indie, we mean not the big five studios. And there's not many of those studios in the middle range, right? Like there's A24 and Focus is owned by somebody else, and Sony Classics,
yeah,
is
IFC and stuff like that. Yeah.
Yeah. But this is true indie. There's no studio backing this. Yeah. This is, you know, self-funded, well, crowdfunded, and but a throwback in all the regards. But sorry, I agree. I think it looks great. There's some really good shots. Even in the trailer, you see some of these fantastic camera shots. And coverage too, like, because that's the other thing. This movie has tons of coverage. Like, there's cool cuts, there's cool editing. A character like comes out of a garage, and like the way it it's supposed to feel like, is it a monster or not? Because we're not really sure what's going on right now. And like it cuts to a close up of like barbecue tongs, and it's not stuff you would see in a lot of indie films where they took the time to get all those shots. You know, a lot of times indie films are set the camera, film the sequence, go to the next sequence. You know, yep. And that's understandable because, again, it's budget and time. But when you're prepared and you have a vision in mind, you can execute it. I mean, I think he crushes it.
Yeah, yeah, no. I think it looks very good. And like I say, I've seen films made with low budget before, and the limitations are there to see. Let's say, even if it's got a good story, there are things that take you out of the immersion, which are out of the control of the filmmaker sometimes. But I generally mm-hmm. didn't get that. The Sundance comparison is bang on here. It does feel like that. I was saying, we mentioned Edgar Wright. There's a lot of Wrightisms about this in a way that the editing is done, a way that we get some of the transitions, and even in the use of shallow focus. Yes. Alejandro does enjoy a shallow focus, and I have no issue with that if it is used well. It can be overused, as can other things I saw in this film, but I think we got a very decent balance, including the non-use of static camera. Again, a limitation sometimes is you put the camera on the tripod and it's static because it's easier, cheaper, quicker, insert adjective here, to film. Whereas here, the way the camera moved was what I enjoyed. Sometimes you could tell it was that nice handheld, little bit of shake to it, and I enjoyed that. Other times it was static, but it was the framing. A lot of shots were framed, probably quite hard shots to get as well. Mm-hmm. Shots in a car, shots in a bathroom. In the mirror, exactly. Or shots against a payphone window. I mean, that felt quaint. Damn, that made me feel old. Somebody picked up a payphone and little things like that, JB. And they also captured the feeling of the kind of odd feeling that was around things. I remember Y2K, almost said Y2J then, Y2K. I remember that very well. And the idea that planes were going to fall out of the sky and your electrics were going to blow up, burning the house down, everyone was going to die. And it was the weirdest thing, because in the end of it, all it did was, the clocks changed. That was pretty much it. But people thought that the computer in a plane would reset itself to 1900, which would then somehow make the plane think, hold on, I don't exist. And it was madness. Hearing the dial-up modem was a delight as well. That hit me right in the feels.
Even the joke, because he lets it just sit there with the dial up, and you're just like, yep, that's how it was.
I mean, sometimes the camera is just left to linger, and I enjoyed that. And then it's up to the performers then to sell that, to keep you invested, because you are just looking at this big old Apple iMac computer, the old ones of with the colourful backs, nice blue one. And two characters, they've got to sell that. And I think they do. The dialogue is sharp and witty. At times, it did run the risk to me of getting a bit too clever, or where we'd get the camera would zoom into someone's face. They'd almost look just past the camera and give a one-liner. Towards the middle, I did start to worry we were going to get into that territory too much. However, it stopped at that point, and it started to go back into its more natural flow. And films like this can sometimes feel unnatural. And I'm not going to say that every single line uttered was great or perfectly written, because sometimes it did feel a bit unnatural or a bit over, a bit acted. And some of the pop culture references were there, sometimes you can pull back on one or two of those. But overall, though, I really enjoyed the back and forth between our two characters. I enjoyed the way the film looked. Like I said, I think the original score, music, I think I saw it's done by a band called Please, and I enjoyed it. I enjoyed a kind of indie alt rock styling, because it fit the role very well, fit the film very well. But overall, JB, no, I think it's a really decent 90-minute film, which captures a lot of feels, for one. But we go through a gamut of emotions. We get to laugh at times. We get to cringe at times. We get to we get to see anger. We get to see restrained fury. And we get to see expressed fury as well throughout this film. There's a great scene, there's a great argument scene, when it kind of feels like, two characters finally just erupt. They finally let their feelings out, for better or worse. And I think the film actually needed that as well, because at times where we were going with the narrative of the characters, I cared a little bit more about one character's struggles than one of the other ones. I felt one of them felt a little bit more real. But I think all roads leading to this kind of major bust up or major truth telling session, I think that really, really helped, actually, because it allowed us to feel where both characters were, where their heads were, where their fears were, where their trauma lay, where their worries were. And I think we needed that to then set up the rest of the film. And it ends very nicely. I enjoyed that. I like after this kind of major argument, there is an almost relative quiet which comes with it. I think that's very good filmmaking, to have you have your explosion, then you almost have a little bit of time to sit with it. But no, I enjoyed this film an awful lot, JB. I do, honestly, and I'll say it hand on heart, genuinely think it's an extremely solid film. I do believe people should go out and check it out. I will say it one more time. I am not in the game to lie. I'm not in the game to make up good reviews. And for what? A pat on the back from who? I enjoyed this film. I think this film was very good. I think Alejandro and the guys did very well. Katie Erin was very good as a lead. I enjoyed Margot Lovato. A few stumbles along the way, notwithstanding, in terms of some of the dialogue, I think the film looked very impressive given the budget. And I don't think it, like you said, like we've both said, I don't think it's derogatory to mention the budget and to praise the way that the budget was utilized, because $50,000 is, in terms of film, it's some people buy a camera for $50,000 and that is it. Here you've got to make your entire film, and it's not just, you know, a film isn't just 1.5 hours and then it's done. It is weeks and weeks and weeks, sometimes months of planning, of scouting, of casting, of paying people, of feeding people, of all that stuff. I generally think this is an extremely good film, and I really do hope more people get to watch it, John. If we can help even 5, 10, 15 people watch this film and check it out, I'd like to see what Alejandro does next, given the opportunity. And hey, look, maybe that $50,000 budget will go up to $100,000, and then before we know it, he's got a $10 million budget on his hands. But genuinely, go check out this film, especially if you like, indie coming-of-age drama films, which feel bigger than they have any right to. So yeah, I really enjoyed it, John, genuinely.
And that is our review of Millennium Bugs. Again, that should be out on February 7th on iTunes, maybe some of the other VOD platforms, but definitely on iTunes. Remember, you don't have to have an iPhone or an iPad to use iTunes to rent movies. I don't even know if it's still called iTunes. I think they phased it out. I think it's now like Apple Movies or something like that.
Even iTunes feels quaint, John.
Yeah, but it's the Apple market where you can, but not, that sounds, yes, weird. It's Apple where you can store, buy digital content from Apple. Rent or buy this, check it out, and leave feedback. Because again, the more people that talk about this movie, the more people are going to get to see it. If you don't like it, of course, you can also say that. That's not me saying, like, if you like it, but you know, if you enjoy this, tell other people. Again, I think if you like Clerks, if you like movies set in the 90s, this one is probably going to be your cup of tea.
This has got a Clerks feel to it as well. I'm assuming it's deliberate at times, of course. There are some very, very kind of deliberate nods without feeling like it's patting you on the back and saying, hey, look what we're doing here. It was very kind of subtle, unsubtle nod, which I enjoyed.
I agree. That's our review, folks. I think we'll be saying this is fresh.
Yes, sir.
And that will lead us to our next segment, which is Chuffed Headlines. This is movie or pop culture news that caught our attention over the week since we last recorded. Matt, yours makes sense given our last week's topics. What is your headline?
Yes, sir, John. After last week when we went through the Oscar nominations for 2023 and some of the surprises to us, some of the surprises to the masses, none more so to the outrage of the internet, John. Outrage. Some of it I understand, but outrage nonetheless, that Andrea Riseborough was nominated for her performance in To Leslie in the Best Actress role. The Oscars late last week said that they were going to be looking into the campaign that she that took place, shall we say, whether or not she was behind it, I don't know, but her management, the campaign that took place online involving many A-listers who were championing the film very late on in the process and putting on screenings and saying what it was the greatest performance of all time. The Academy were looking at that as if to see whether it broke any rules. Was there any campaigning rules broken by this free campaign online? Lots of people again online have been having their say. A lot of people think Andrea Riseborough's nomination came at the expense of black actresses, Danielle Derweiler, Viola Davis. Others say, well, we don't know who was in the sixth and seventh places. It could have been Mia Goth for all we know. However, the precedent was set with this new way of campaigning, and the Oscars have now said, the Academy have now said, they're not going to be taking any punitive action in response to the divisive campaign, their words, not mine, for Andrea Riseborough. This came from Scott Feinberg over at The Hollywood Reporter. And they're saying, and I quote, the CEO of the Academy, Bill Kramer, said, the Academy has determined the activity in question does not rise to the level that the film's nomination should be rescinded. He added, however, we did discover social media and outreach campaigning tactics that caused concern. These tactics are being addressed with responsible parties directly. So, in a nutshell, they're not rescinding the nomination. However, they think there is a few things wrong with this, or they don't maybe agree with the ethics behind it. It's a funny one, John. And I know we mentioned it last week. It's a funny one because studios pump millions of dollars. We know that into pushing their talent, into pushing their films. They spend millions of dollars on what? The chance to get their talent's name on a ballot. Whereas Andrea Riseborough's team had this unconventional grassroots idea to just, you know, ask her friends to campaign on her behalf. Now, the fact that whether they saw the film or not was not in question because they had, you know, they were hosting these parties. But it was more about the fact that a lot of people take umbrage with lots of very white A-listers were pushing this very white actress at the expense of certainly Viola Davis and Danielle Deadwyler, because one prominent, I think, Academy voter said that they were shoo-ins. I can't remember her name. They said those two are lock-ins, so don't worry about them. They're going to be fine, Danielle and Viola. Look at Andrea Riseborough. Let's get her a nomination. And, you know, it wasn't right to say that those two actors were lock-ins when nobody knows if they were as well. And to then essentially push them out was wrong. Mm. It's poor form, and it's not a good look. But I've seen two, Leslie. Andrea Riseborough is fantastic. But I think... For me, John, they were never, ever going to rescind Andrea Riseborough's nomination. What I actually expected them to do was similar to what they've done, but maybe a bit more transparent. I expected them to say the nomination stands. However, from next year, these are the rules. We're changing the rules so it doesn't happen again, or whatever it is they want to say. Whereas they've kind of said, you know, some of the campaigning wasn't up to our processes, so we're looking at that, but we're going to keep it as it is. I think it would have been even more of a drama and of a fuss if they did take her out, because then what do they do then? I believe the rules are if you remove someone, you can't replace them. So it would have only been four nominations and nobody else would have taken her place anyway. And also at the same time, Danielle Deadwyler, Viola Davis, or looking further out, someone like Amir Goth, do you think they would want to come in and be like and be given a late nomination, and which is almost not necessarily a sympathy vote, but a kind of, it's like being awarded the medal.
Call it that. Yeah,
exactly. It's like being awarded the medal after someone's had to be disqualified. It's like, well, I finished fourth or wherever it is. I don't really deserve the bronze medal, or they may feel like they don't deserve. The problem is all of those performers I mentioned, Danielle, Viola and Mia Goth, for example, are all fantastic. So they all deserve to be there, but can only have five, which is a problem. So I'm not surprised by this, John. I'm not surprised that they didn't rescind it. I'm not surprised that they've said, oh, we found a few irregularities here. And I'm not here to debate who should have and shouldn't have been in there. I think there are other people within that best actress lineup who could have been swapped out for two of the three that I've just mentioned. But at the end of the day, the five nominations are out. I can't change them. Nobody else can change them. These are our nominations. And at the end of the day, if you liked the other people's performances better, it doesn't change a thing, does it, JB? So you hear this news. What are your thoughts on this? Did you expect any more action taken, or was this to be expected?
No, I think we will see this change, like, in the future, how they let people, obviously that's what they're threatening, at least, that they will be more mindful of, like, how people campaign for their nominations. It's wild because this reminds me of, like, a high school homecoming thing, because they're not supposed to campaign for, like, homecoming king and queen, but we know that they do, because you can't control that kind of stuff. You can't control, like, social media. Like, we can stop them from putting posters up at the school. We can stop them, you know, but they have friends. They have, you know, obviously Andrea Riseborough has connections, and she has people who wanted to root for her, and they made sure she got nominated for the homecoming court. You know, there's one thing I realized about this process that I've never really thought to ask. But, like, we know who the five nominations are right now. Do they re-vote from this five to pick the winner, or is the winner already chosen from the initial voting?
Now that the vote, my understanding, and I believe, is that these are the five now who are put forward. So they have to now re-vote on every category, specifically this category. So there's nothing to say that Andrea Riseborough, she can win this because she's in there. It's not a foregone conclusion that Michelle Yeoh or Kate Blanchett could win. Some of these Academy voters who maybe hadn't seen Two, Leslie, may watch it and think, actually, yeah, I'm going to pick her. And to be fair, the Academy does like drama, John.
Yeah. I mean, we're talking about it again, right? Like, we have, what, a month still before we see the Oscars?
Yeah.
And yet here we are the second or third week in a row that we're talking about this. Obviously, the drama helps people. You know, no publicity is bad publicity. So here it is.
Yep.
Proof in the pudding.
Yep. So there we go.
My headline for this week I'm going to nitpick poor Robert Zemeckis, man. A guy who's made some of my favorite movies. I adore Who Framed Roger Rabbit, and I love the Back to the Future trilogy. I am a huge fan of the entire trilogy, even saying the third one being my favorite. I love all three, though. And I like many other Zemeckis films. But we've known for the last 20 years now that he gets obsessive over technology and is willing to sacrifice a lot of other elements of filmmaking to explore techniques, right? Like, we've seen him obsess over the motion capture stuff. He won't let it go, because we even brought it back with Marwan, and he brought it back with Pinocchio or something. I don't exactly know how he did the Pinocchio stuff, but I believe there was some motion capture there.
Yes.
Well, he's latched onto a new technology, and it's this trend with de-aging, but specifically with AI de-aging. Apparently, on America's Got Talent, metaphysics was they did something on America's Got Talent where they showed their de-aging technology, and Zemeckis got excited about it. And for his new film, which is an adaptation of Richard McGuire's book, I assume, Here, I don't know anything about it. But it's going to star Tom Hanks and Robin Wright and other people. And apparently everyone's going to be de-aged by AI. I am not super familiar with metaphysics. The de-aging tech has been debated for a minute now.
Yeah.
There's a lot. I mean, movies have had younger characters. I mean, De Niro and, why does this happen?
Which film are you thinking of? The Irishman?
Godfather 2. That De Niro plays the younger version of Don Corleone, right?
Yes.
Marlon Brando. God. They don't look alike to me. Mm-hmm. When I look at Robert De Niro.
Look at Looper as well. Look at Looper.
Yeah. Yeah. Joseph Gordon-Levitt, Bruce Willis.
Yep.
Nope. Nothing. But do you understand it? Yes. Yes, we do, because that's movies. So there's plenty of evidence throughout the history of film that we don't need the same actor to play the younger version of themselves, nor do we need to make them look younger in order for us to get it. And then, of course, there's even an example recently from Little Women where Florence Pugh plays the younger version of herself that in the original stories doesn't work because she's way younger than Florence Pugh is at the young parts of that character. But you know what? I was fine with it because Florence Pugh is a terrific actress, and I was okay with her being in the movie more. You know what I'm saying? So, like, I don't think we need the de-aging tech. In some cases, I think it's been powerful. I think it was fine when they did it with Iron Man and what was it? Civil War? Not Civil War.
Infinity War.
No, it was Civil War.
Yes, it was, because they did it when with his name as well.
Yeah. And they've done it a few times now. And obviously, as you mentioned, The Irishman is like one of the most expensive Netflix movies of all time because of all of the de-aging tech. And I think the criticism of that was you can make the face look younger, but he still moves like an old man because he's an old man. Like, you can tell it's not a young version of him. And that's, are we going to have that same problem here? Probably. And again, Zemeckis has put technology over quality too many times now for us to be excited about this. Honestly, when I saw it was Robin Wright and Tom Hanks, I was like, are we getting Forrest Gump 2 now? Are they going to de-age them that much? Like, what's going on? But that's not the case. I don't know anything about Here. So it's not like I want Here to be great. I'm not like a fan of the book or anything. Oh, it's a graphic novel. I'm scrolling through the article. Like, I'm like, oh yeah. Okay. Here it is. But I didn't even need to read the article to know I needed to talk about this, because it's like,
yeah.
Robert Zemeckis, please, guy. I know you can make – I want to believe that those early movies were not the flukes, that these later movies are just a symbol of you focusing on the wrong part of filmmaking, similar to Ang Lee, who has now fixated on the high frame rate stuff. You guys can make – and it's your life. Make whatever movies you want. You've obviously – Zemeckis isn't hurting for money. He's got his big movies out there. At least I don't know that for a fact. Obviously, I'm just assuming that he's still making tons of royalties off of Back to the Future, since he owns all of the rights to those. Him and Bob Gale own all the rights to those movies. But you know, I'm not hyped for this. Again, even if it were another filmmaker, I think I'd be like, oh, another de-aging thing. But because it's Zemeckis, I'm all the more apprehensive about this. What do you think, Matt? What are your thoughts?
Yeah, not a million miles different from yourself. Zemeckis and his overuse, over-reliance on technology, on style over substance for me in recent years has been damaging to his reputation for me. Now, we'll always have the classics that he gave us a few decades ago now. They'll always be there. But I think his use of the technology has hindered his storytelling for me. I think there is an over-reliance on it. So when I see that you're going to take two fantastic actors in Tom Hanks and Robin Wright and use a de-aging technology, I worry. However, in this instance, I'm not as worried, because by the sounds of it, the two actors are going to be playing younger versions of themselves as well. Now, we watched a film recently called A Man Called Otto, where Tom Hanks had somebody playing a younger version of himself.
Yep.
His own kid, his own son, Chet. So yeah, they could have gone down that route. Maybe that would have been, like you were saying, maybe that would have been a little bit better. Would it have been a dead-on replica or clone of a younger self? Maybe not, but that then comes down to the performance of whoever you get and the casting of who you get to play the younger versions of your lead actors. We've seen some good de-aging. This was a 2-second shot in a trailer, but I think Harrison Ford in the new indie film, that de-aging looked spot on. The use of the deepfake, the Book of Boba Fett, it was Mando 2.5. The use of Luke Skywalker there, facially, it just knocked me on the floor. The voice is what they need to get right. They need to add some soul to those voices. The difference being, though, well, maybe it won't be. The difference is they didn't use Mark Hamill's voice. They used a re-speecher and an electronic. They used software to recreate his voice. Mark Hamill's still alive, but they went down that route. Tom Hanks and Robin Wright are clearly still alive because they're in the film. Now, do they alter their own voices, or do they get, you know, voice actors in to come in? What are they? That's what I'm more interested in, because they're getting better with the eyes, but it's the mouth movements and making it not feel like a video game cutscene, which is the problem. Yep. That's what I worry about now. Deepfake. I know there's also been an awful lot of controversy about deepfake in the adult movie industry this week, and how potentially that very damaging. We've mentioned this before, that, you know, you could get John Burke's face or my face or anyone and put it anywhere you want in any situation or any event or whatever scenario, and you could do it, and it's happening, and it's very, very, very bad, worrying, the reach that this technology has. However, keeping it on film, when used correctly, I think it can be a powerful tool. Not necessarily always too keen on using it to bring back actors who are no longer with us. I do think there's an ethical and a moral quandary there to jump through, even if the family gives you their permission. Yeah, and I think we've said before, we're going to get to a point now where, you know, sadly, actors will pass away, and in their will, it will say whether or not you can have your likeness used. We're going to get to that point now. But in this instance, kind of wish they just got younger actors to play them, JB. I don't know. Again, I don't know the story, so I don't know if it's them when it's 10 years ago or 5 years ago, where maybe it's not quite as practical to do that. But if it's them when they're in their teens and 20s and 30s, just get younger actors. I can't knock Zemeckis for wanting to use technology and further technology, because, you know, I'd be hypocritical when I look at someone like George Lucas and worship at his altar of what he gave cinema and what he gave film in terms of technological advancements in visually and sound and filmmaking. So Zemeckis is just playing with a new tool. He's playing with the deepfake technology. Hey, look, if he does it well, we'll sit here and say, wow, did you see that? Looked like I was watching Tom Hanks in Big or something like that. You know, that if they get it right. But there's always that uncanny thing, isn't there, John? Is it the uncanny valley? There's always that thing where we know we're not watching Tom Hanks from 30 years or Robin Wright from 30 years. So they've got to get over that. Now, in this instance, I'm not as worried as I would be. Had it been like an AI film or similar to his other films, then I probably would have just thrown this in the bin. But because we're actually going to get actual performances out of the actors mixed in with some deepfake, if he can direct them well and make them feel like younger versions of themselves and they can do a job, then job well done. But because of the last few Zemeckis films, I come into this with anxiety, with a little bit of apprehension, JB, an open mind nonetheless.
Yeah, again, I'm always hopeful because, again, I do think Zemeckis is a – I feel like he's a capable filmmaker. I have a friend who would say otherwise, but that it was like a fluke that his early stuff was good and maybe it only shows. But that my fear is that he will sacrifice story for tech, and that seems to have been the trend. Not true with Polar Express necessarily, but I think of those three that he's like full stop motion or motion capture.
Yep.
I wish it was stop motion. The motion capture stuff. He seems to be willing to. He's more concerned with using the tech in fun and interesting ways at the cost of the story or at the cost of the experience. And
yes,
that's
yes.
my concern.
Yeah, same here, JB. Hopefully that won't happen in the film here, H-E-R-E. But there is always that hesitation, man.
Well, that is our headlines for the week. Let's go to media consumption. This is movies, TV, video games, music, podcasts, not ours, or anything else we use to pass the time between recordings, the media that we consume. Matt, what have you been consuming since the last time we recorded?
It's been John. I'm not going to keep you long on this one, John. I was supposed to watch Missing last night. With an unlimited screening, but I couldn't make it because I wasn't feeling very well. Another deadly migraine. I thought I was so bummed out because at the unlimited screening, it's with the unlimited card we get over here. They put on early screenings of films, and this one was Missing, which I didn't get the email about. So I saw it a few days back. I go onto the Cineworld website and see what I can pre-order my tickets for in advance. And I saw Missing. I thought, hot damn, I'm all over this. So I booked it, but unfortunately couldn't get to see it, which is a shame because that would have been a boss film to cover in the next few weeks. But alas, I will keep my eyes out for another showing coming forward, or I'll just hassle the studio for it now that I almost saw it. I'll use that against them. So I haven't actually watched any films this week, John. There is a reason for that other than Millennium Bugs. Before that, I listened to the Happy, Sad, Confused podcast where Josh Horowitz interviewed Bella Ramsey of Game of Thrones and, of course, The Last of Us fame. And that was a fun interview, listening to, obviously, Bella's experiences working on The Last of Us working with the cast, the crew, the actors, her experience and what she brought to the role of Ellie and how she worked with Ashley Johnson, who was the mocap and voice of the video game adaptation of Ellie, and her thoughts on the announcement that they were getting a season 2 now. Now, we always knew, well, I say we, it was always a given, I think, from what we've heard from Naughty Dog and the inside rumbling, that this was going to get a second season. They just needed to get that, almost that validation after the first few episodes that people wanted it. However, part 2 of the game, The Last of Us Part 2, is massive. It is an absolute monster. There's no way in a million years of Sundays or a million episodes of the BAMP can they cover The Last of Us Part 2 in one season of 9 episodes. So I expect them to be announcing a season 3 quite not long after that season premieres. But The Last of Us is very relevant, John, because that's all I've been watching this week. The Last of Us Episode 3 to 9, because my buddy Bespin Bulletin, his alias that is, asked, he's a big fan of The Last of Us, and he asked a few weeks ago if I'd be up for talking about the episodes and dropping a weekly release of a review of the episodes, because as I mentioned, I was very lucky to get from HBO and Sky advanced link screening links. So I've seen all 9 and I've still got them for the next 4 days as of recording. So I said, yeah, of course. However, I don't really want to do 9 and don't want to do 9 weeks of this. I mean, everyone's busy. So we decided let's truncate it into like 2.5-3 weeks. So every 2 or 3 days, we'll watch an episode, we record, and then it's in the bag and then it's done with then. So I've been watching episodes 3 through 9 and recording these episodes in amongst doing Star Wars sessions, in amongst getting ready for the BAMP and work and that. So no films for me this week though, JB, though I have bought some today. I bought Requiem for a Dream. I got that from the local, not quite nice, dollar store, but give or take. This one's going to surprise you because it surprised me, John. But you know what it's like to be a completionist, even in the face of reason. I've got Halloween Kills. It was like £2, which is what, $3. I was like, you know what? I've got the first Halloween at 2018. this is the extended cut, so Evil's going to die for a bit longer tonight. But I had to get it to go with the collection. It, you know, David Gordon Green's first Halloween looked a bit lonely up there. I got Requiem for a Dream. I think that's the only two I got today. I was going to get a few more, but I thought I'd save the pounds. But I've literally just been watching The Last of Us, John. Now, I will throw this back over to you as well, because Episode 3 came out of The Last of Us. That's the latest one. I said in my review, and I think I might have got told off by HBO for it. That was for something else. But I said in my review that, you know, I really think The Last of Us is prestige television, is top tier. A few issues notwithstanding, I think we could have done with one or two more episodes. Just wait and see. But I put in my review, Episode 3 was spectacular. So Episode 3 was, you know, monumentally good television to the point where it is actually eligible to be a feature film. And I couldn't wait for John to watch this. I know you said you'd watched episodes 1 and 2 and we're digging it. I couldn't wait for you to watch Episode 3 because I know you and your sensibilities and your taste for good television, for good storytelling, for good romance, for good everything. This episode had it in spades. I've seen it 3 times now, and every time this episode gets me, Nick Offerman and Murray Bartlett are out of this world good. And to the people who say that Episode 3 doesn't play a part in the story, it was filler. Oh, we don't. What do we need this stuff for? Firstly, check it. Leave it at the door, because we know where you're coming from with that rubbish. You can review bomb all you want. People love this episode. This episode, and it's not. This isn't any spoiler for the rest of the season. It's a spoiler for Episode 3. This episode means everything to the season.
It does.
Without this episode, the relationship between Joel and Ellie does not solidify. They do not get closer. Things do not happen because of this. I want to hear what you thought, but I thought Episode 3 was, this is some, without rhetoric, without any BS, this is one of the best episodes of television I have ever seen, because of the writing, the performances, the structure, the pacing, the emotion within it. It blew me away. John, is this where you're going to tell me you thought it was filler and you hated it?
No, I completely agree with you. I've used that same expression. This might be one of the best episodes of TV ever. And I say that as a big fan of the video game. I say that as a increasingly big fan of Pedro Pascal. I love him.
But did you expect an episode like this in The Last of Us? Like, you expect Infected? You expect a bit of horror maybe? Did you expect them to drop an episode as profound as this?
I don't know for sure that I want to say I did, but I hold those games in such high regard because of the characters. Like, I do find the tension and the suspense and the monster. I think the creature design in Last of Us is amazing. I think the look of those creatures is both terrifying, but maybe it's terrifying because it feels grounded in a lot of ways, more so than some other zombie type games. But it is the characters. It's Joel and Ellie that brought me back to Last of Us 2. Like, I was so hyped for Last of Us 2, and that was one of the games that I finally caved and bought a PlayStation. I had been an Xbox exclusive for most of the time that PS3 was a thing. I came in at the very end of PS3. When I bought it, I knew I was going to play Uncharted. I knew I was going to play God of War. But I finally caved because I saw Last of Us. I'm like, that looks like the game I've been waiting for. And it was why I immediately jumped into PS4, because I knew we were probably going to get a sequel. And I was one of the early supporters of that. The sequel got a lot of the same type of hate that you're seeing for Episode 3 for a lot of the same reasons, realistically.
I loved that game.
Me too. I find Ellie and that whole world, I just think the world building of The Last of Us is incredible. And where I think so many fans in many of the adaptations of video games that we are worried is that they'll fail to give us that same experience. And where this show is proving that you can do it well is, one, you don't have to recreate it exactly for us, the fans, to be happy. You need to have a sense of the tone. You need to have a sense of what the game is about and the themes, and find ways to make it original, which is what I love so much about Episode 3. To be fair, as much as I love the game, I played it when it came out. I don't remember everything. I remember my feelings. I remember my love of the game. I don't remember every single character. I don't remember every single plot beat. I remember things that freaked me out or things that like stood out as I played. But I had to look up Bill. I didn't remember exactly what Bill did in the game because I knew it wasn't exactly the same in the episode, but I was like, am I not remembering this or do I just not remember everything? And it was Bill, a combination. I remember minor parts.
Character.
But what they do here is incredible storytelling. And the fact that it doesn't feel like a side thing or an adjacent thing or something that they've crammed into an otherwise IP that we are familiar with is they get what was necessary. We've had a few changes, but I think all those changes have worked. I don't necessarily think they're better or worse. I do think what they did with Bill is better, but like some of the other changes that I won't get into specifics, I don't know if they're better or worse in the game, but they're cool changes that I love. It gives me hope that this won't just be a rehash of the game, right? Like, because we already have the game.
Yeah, yeah.
I want to have the same experience.
You've got to adapt it for a different medium, haven't you? You have to adapt it. You can't. In a game, you're playing it, you're controlling the narrative, you have gameplay mechanics that just exist because video games. You can't do that in a TV show, so you have to change it up.
And finding ways to do that without it feeling like a betrayal is hard. And that's why I think so many video game adaptations either don't work or work because they let, like, Sonic only works because they're not trying to be the games, right? Like, you're not getting the story the same way you get it in the games. This works both ways. You are getting the elements from the story that are necessary, but they're adapting it as a movie or a show. And it works so well. This episode is fantastic. Obviously I watched this as well. I wasn't sure what to expect. You kind of had hyped this up, and then I saw David Ehrlich hype it up. Big Tuna, who doesn't always agree with Ehrlich, sent me Ehrlich's review and was like, I completely agree with this. I'm like, wow, okay, what am I getting into? And then when I watched the episode, it wasn't what I was expecting.
Yeah,
it was far better, though, in a lot of ways than what my brain was thinking it must be.
And the emotional aspects of the game in terms of the character's sexuality, that's in the game. This isn't some, you know, the woke of us. They've gone, what? No. You know, again, leave that alone. Just get lost.
I've managed to avoid seeing a lot of that stuff. I haven't looked at reviews. I've managed to not see that.
Some.
I know it's out there.
I looked at the hashtag and it was out like, come on, guys. It also made me, it helped me with my blocking spree. I knew how to block, but everything's in the game. It's there. All they're doing is taking what they did in the game in 2013 and were maybe a bit hesitant to build upon because reasons back then, and they've decided no. You know, with the Left Behind DLC, with Last of Us Part 2, they've shown they can handle their gay characters with confidence and with some very good writing, and they've done the same here. And I think that shouldn't be applauded because, again, it should be natural and normal, but it's a very bold swing, I think, to deviate so deftly from the main narrative to give us this episode. But it all plays in, man.
To not, because this is not a review of this show, but to point out, though, like you were saying, if the criticisms that this is a deviation from the main story and an unnecessary episode, something that TV has always done, mind you, like that's an important thing to note that TV has always had these kind of deviation episodes, and sometimes they work really, really well and sometimes they don't. Let's be real. The best part of the Book of Boba Fett were the deviations with Mandalorian. Like, those were the best episodes. But here, the deviation isn't like, let's pause the plot and then go watch something else. This is, let's make sure the plot makes sense. We need to motivate the characters in a way that will have a lasting impact and that the audience will understand and see parallels. And that what I think, I haven't seen the last six episodes, so they could drop the ball from here. But from what I've heard, this is a really important, like, keystone to the plot working.
Yep.
And I get that. And that's what the only thing for me now is, like, if they don't live up to what I see happening, I'll be disappointed. But if it does, this series is going to be one of my favorite TV series of all time, and I hope that happens because it's one of my favorite video games of all time.
Let's hope, John. I will leave you to continue now. All I will say is nearly 31,000 people have given this a 1-star rating on IMDb.
Well, that's insane. I
would
really love to see a Red Dead Redemption TV series because that's one of my other favorite video games.
Huge.
Like, I don't care which game. You can go one or two. I'm in. Love those games. And I like a Western. So let's get, you know, Deadwood worked. let's make Red Dead Redemption the series, HBO. Anyways, that's all for you, that which is a lot of TV, mind you, but what podcasts can people episodes. Listen to?
It was it's called ClickerCast, the Last of Us podcast. It's on my main feed. It's just excuse me, it comes out every Monday. It's a spoiler episode as well, so you haven't seen the episode. It's a spoiler episode, and the episodes don't generally go on for any longer than the actual television episode series runtime does. So you're looking at kind of 45, 50, 60 minutes tops.
I'm hyped to jump into my consumption this week. So Blank Check is covering Danny Boyle. We got Trainspotting, which is like that's the reason we're talking about Danny Boyle, right? Because that movie is a success. I'm a big fan of it. It's a really good episode. Highly recommend you listen to it. Choose life, indeed. I watched The Last of Us. I'm going to stay with TV for a second. I finally jumped in, Matt. I watched Andor episodes 1 and 2 the other night.
I didn't see it on your list.
Yeah, I kind of blended it in with The Last of Us. Obviously you've been recommending it. My editor for Burke Reviews, David, he just finally finished the series. It was raving about it. I've heard good things all over the place. Everyone's wrong. No, it's actually, I gotta say, the thing that I like the most, I just like the look of the show. Like, it looks real good and
all practical, all on set, no volume.
It's noticeable, right? Like, it's so noticeable. Yes. I'm really vibing the feel of the show so far. No, I've only watched the first 2 episodes, and then I've been busy the rest of the week, so I've not been able to go back to it, but I plan to.
That's one very of interesting, John, because I'm sorry, again, I keep interrupting you like an Englishman, only because of the passion. That's very interesting, because over on Sessions, Luke, myself, my co-host, when we saw it, we were lucky enough to see the first 3 in London, and after the first 2 episodes, I turned to him as big Star Wars fans and said, where are we going with this? Not because they weren't good episodes, but for me, that third episode was like, right, I get it. It ties it all up now. So I'm going to tell him that you watched the first 2 and were pleasantly surprised.
But keep in mind, I love it's Diego Luna, right?
Yes, sir.
I like him a lot anyways. I'm coming into the show with so much praise that I don't know if it's fair to use those comparisons. Because like, you guys saw it when no one else had seen it. I'm coming in with so many people I trust telling me I need to watch this. And I'm like, I have no complaints. Isn't that enough? Like, you know what I'm saying? Like, there's nothing. I'm not sitting here going, well, this is bad. I'm sitting here going, okay, all right. I like Diego Luna. I like the droid.
B2 Emo.
He stutters.
Yep.
It's so sweet. Like, he's such a cute droid. I'm kind of, I hate that Star Wars can do that to me. Gosh darn it. You know how much Grogu stuff I still have? Like, it needs to stop. But I'm not buying any of the droid stuff, but I'm sure it's out there. So I did watch the first 2. I'm going to keep watching. I've played God of War Ragnarok more. I still have a lot to go. I've only been able to play on weekends. I've just been really busy during the week. Movie wise, though, last week when we finished recording, I jumped in my truck and I drove 45 minutes to go see Infinity Pool, which is wild. I did not see the NC-17 version. I saw the rated R version, which apparently the NC-17 has like full, whether or not it's a stand-in, but a full shot of, and a close-up shot of Alexander Skarsgård, general, if you will. And I didn't get to see that. I'm not complaining, but that's apparently why it's NC-17 in other markets. Ours is just rated R. Still a wild movie. It wasn't as grotesque as I was anticipating because of the Cronenberg signature, which obviously David and is it Brandon?
Brandon, yeah.
They're not the same, but it is interesting that filmmaking style has carried over like that. You know what I'm saying? Like, there is a similarity. Possessor feels a lot more like a David Cronenberg film to me than doesn't.
He still makes odd films. It runs in the family.
And I think that's kind of fun. I like it. I don't think it's a masterpiece or anything. I do think it's worth checking out, especially if you like horror. Mia Goth is just one of my favorite actresses at this point. She's just tremendous.
Absolutely.
I didn't know what her voice sounded like, her real voice. Until the interview you sent me, and I did not listen to the interview until I saw the movie. What's that?
Hello, John. Yeah. This is what my voice sounds like.
I'm watching the movie, like, this is a weird accent she's doing. And then I watched that interview. I'm like, oh, that's her voice. Like, that's just it.
I did not expect that kind of.
I did not.
What do people call an 1800s Victorian British voice coming out of her? But the fact that she can turn on that American accent, certainly in the Ty West films, so effortlessly is
and
wonderful.
Differently because Pearl is a different accent than of course, Maxine. Yeah. This is the movie I want to talk about, Matt. I can't stop thinking about this movie. It's called Onyx the Fortuitous and the Talisman of Souls. I saw this at Sundance. It was part of their Midnight series. Tuna recommended it to me. I don't remember exactly if it was after he saw it. And Tuna's gotten very good at knowing my taste and can often pinpoint when a movie's going to like click for me. I don't think either of us expected it to click this much because I can't wait to see it again. Like I'm still thinking about lines of dialogue from this film, specifically the filmmaker who is also the star and writer. His performance, it's so specific. It's such a character that he's created called Onyx the Fortuitous. That is the character's name. He has a Instagram, both as for the movie, but also I think as himself. And he does this character, apparently this was a pre-existing character I was not familiar with. I was not a built-in fan. I am now. Andrew Bowser is the filmmaker and star. This movie is a throwback to 80s horror in a lot of ways, but like in the campy, like he in the pre-viewing screening of Sundance, he refers to Gremlins and Fright Night, which I love both of those movies. But you also see some Beetlejuice influence here. And you have Barbara Crampton and the dude from Reanimator, whose name I do not know off the top of my head, but the two people are in it. And then I love School of Rock, and the bass player from School of Rock, I don't know how to say it, if it's Rivka Reyes or Rivka Reyes. I'm not 100% how to pronounce that, but she's in this and she's terrific. I love the whole cast. I generally love this movie. I gave it 4.5 stars because I don't think it's like a masterpiece, but for me it might be. I literally was sitting 2 days after watching it, eating my breakfast and just thinking about, I had so much fun watching that movie, and I was like rethinking of scenes. And again,
you said it's not me. Like
it's not a revolutionary, like gonna change the world kind of movie, but man, if you're looking for like a funny, quirky movie with its own kind of agenda, and again, such a distinct vision. Like this dude has such a there's so many scenes that I just crack up when I think about. And a lot of it's practical, which I think also is great. It's like, again, true throwback filmmaking, and it's wonderful. I don't know when you're gonna be able to see it. I haven't found out if it's sold or if it got distribution at Sundance, but Onyx the Fortuitous and the Talisman of Souls, keep your eyes out. If you like horror comedy, especially leaning towards comedy, I would say it's comedy forward with horror being a part of it. But in that, I never thought it was like scary. There's like stuff that happens, but it's more fun than scary. Also at Sundance, I saw Other People's Children. Man, that is an emotional movie. If you are a teacher or a step parent, that movie is going to resonate real hard. It's very powerful.
This is Rebecca Zlotowski, I believe, the director.
Right. I believe so. Yes. And it's the actress from Benedetta.
Oh, is it? That film was divisive, but I thought the performances are excellent in that. I saw a film from this director a few years ago called An Easy Girl. Talking of divisive films, I thought that film was excellent. So I'm really excited to check this out, if it's anything similar to the tone of that film.
I don't know if it's similar in tone because I haven't seen that one, but this one, it's just a really, really good movie. It debuted at TIFF, I believe, and then was at Sundance. But yeah, very, very good. I finally watched All Quiet on the Western Front, the 2022 one that is nominated for Best Picture, the only Best Picture nominee I had not seen previous to the announcement, which bummed me out because I totally went in. I'm like, I watched 180 movies in 2022. There's no way I missed a Best Picture nominee. And I slept on All Quiet, and I blame Netflix because I got 4-year consideration screeners for Glass Onion, for White Noise, and for Pinocchio. Nothing from All Quiet on the Western Front. I didn't even know I was supposed to be considering it as that. And I heard some buzz.
9 Oscar noms or 11 Oscar noms or something mad like that.
What's up with that, Netflix? You didn't think you should back this movie that clearly everyone's loving?
Are you trying to tell me Netflix can't market its films, John?
I mean, I seem to be implying that, Matt, but you know, no way that's possible. But yeah, and boy, they dropped the ball, because it is a really, really good movie. It is hard to deny how impactful that film is. I think the first six, technically it's like the first 12 minutes, because there's some like little bit of like filler content, but the opening sequence of the war, we're introduced to several people, chaos of war, and then how it leads into these scenes of characters being stripped of their uniforms because they're dead, and those uniforms being piled and then sent back and cleaned and stitched and then redistributed. What, I mean, that's like, if you cut there as a short film, what a condemnation of how the upper ruling class treats their soldiers, right?
It's lack of respect for just for human life, lack of remorse.
Exactly. I think that opening sequence alone is worth watching the movie, but the whole film, very powerful, very emotional. I thought pretty great. Some very harrowing sequences. Just, yeah. So a little sad it's a Netflix movie, in that I wish I could have saw it on the big screen. I think it would be very cool on the big screen.
Yes.
I'm not going to talk much about it, but I did see the new M. Night Shyamalan movie, Knock at the Cabin, which we will be talking about next week.
Yes, I'm seeing this tomorrow, I think.
Well, I will save most of my thoughts, but I am excited to talk about it. And then last month I mentioned I am doing a challenge this year, the Other Filmmakers Challenge, that Flicks Chick, I believe I'm saying a bad word, folks, Flick Chick Bitch, that's her Instagram name, has been pushing, I know. Remember, each month they're going to give three prompts, and the goal is to watch just three movies a month that meet the prompts that either have a female director, a trans director, or a non-binary director at the helm. And so I watched The Secret Life of Bees, because one of the prompts this month is a black filmmaker. And I've seen almost all of Gina Prince-Bythewood's filmography, but when I was listening to the Blank Check podcast, I did not have access to Secret Life of Bees. It was not streaming at the time. I didn't have the money to just shell out, so I didn't. And I noticed it was on HBO Max, and I was like, well, I'm going to jump into it. So I watched Secret Life of Bees last night, and good movie. It's a really good movie. Alicia Keys, I think, maybe needs to act a little more, because I think she's terrific in this movie. I was really impressed how good she was. And I always like Queen Latifah. I think Queen Latifah does not get enough respect as an actress. She brings just almost instant pathos with a character. Like, I'm immediately like, I think you're so kind and caring. I get your whole persona with her body language, her demeanor. I think she's terrific in this. And that's the thing, that I think Dakota Fanning is great. I was surprised that she is the centerpiece of the movie, because it's like, there's a lot of interesting stuff happening. I almost don't want to follow her character. Like, you know, I don't know, but really good movie. Check it out. Gina Prince-Bythewood, maybe an underrated director, because she's really good. Like, all of her movies are good. And what a diverse filmography too. Like, you go from like Love and Basketball, which is a terrific rom-com, or even just a romance. I don't know if it's fair to call it a comedy. I like The Old Guard. I think The Old Guard's very good. I think The Women King is one of the biggest snubs at the Oscars this year, because that movie's phenomenal.
She got nominated for Bambi by me for Best Director.
Yeah. I can't think of what it's called, but her like Star Is Born type movie that is really good. Bright Lights. I can't think of what it's called off the top of my head.
I can't remember.
But she's a terrific director. The Blank Check episodes, again, only support that claim. But that's what I've been watching. You know, and in my film classes, we are prepping. One class is going to be starting musicals. One class is starting science fiction. And then my IB film class for the month of February, we're diving into black filmmakers. So we're focusing in on directors and or movies that feature either black stories or black filmmakers for the month of February to celebrate Black History Month. So we watched Steve McQueen's Lovers Rock yesterday in class.
Nice.
Which is part of it's technically a TV series, because of the way the BBC did the Small Axe series, but it's a 75 minute movie, and none of the episodes are directly related to each other. They are all thematically and setting wise related, but they are different stories. But Lover's Rock is a really cool mood piece, and I not all of my kids vibed with it, because it is a mood piece. It's not a traditional narrative in any way, but the ones that did vibe with it enjoyed it, so it was cool.
Nice.
that's basically our episode, folks. But before I let Matt leave, before I just let him go back to the world of tea and crumpets, I must make sure that he is keeping his bloody awesome levels at peak operating conditions, especially since he's podcasting with so many other people these days. I got to make sure he's, you know, filling up the tank. So, Matt, what have you been doing to stay bloody awesome?
This week, my friend, I've been unwinding somewhere. I've been walking in the air. I haven't been floating and I haven't been smoking my breakfast. I've just been getting out walking, John. Like I said, working, watching lots of stuff and recording things in a short space of time is sounds like a good idea to start with. And then I think, oh man, I can't wait to get back to just doing two a week. So in the meantime, I've just been getting out walking, putting either a podcast in or just music or a soundtrack or like a synth wave kind of playlist, and just getting out and walking, even just for half an hour. Get out, put your headphones on, go for a walk, just to de-stress from a day's work. And I think it's without meaning to turn it into the kind of better health section, but just I do think it's very important to look after yourself and look after your kind of, and make sure you have that time to yourself to chill out, to relax, and do the things that you want to do when you're not necessarily compelled to have to do it, if you know what I mean. I enjoy so much watching films and talking about them, but it is nice sometimes to just think, you know what, only something for me, and even if that is just going out and having a little walk. So I've been making sure I've been doing that, plus gets the steps in, John. You know, the New Year's resolution to lose weight, it's there, and the walks are certainly helping. So that's pretty much it, JB. It's just making sure that you're not just being cooped up at work, at home, watching stuff, talking about it, rinse, repeat type thing. Getting out there and enjoying some fresh air, JB, and I'm telling you something, it's cold over here at the minute. So certainly waking me up a little bit. But what about yourself then, John? I've been walking about. What have you been up to?
Well, I watched a lot of movies last year, the most that I'm aware of in my life. Mm-hmm. 400 movies total, 180 just from the year. And I have definitely, over the last 6 years, neglected a lot of TV series. And so one of my goals for this year is to start bringing TV back a little bit. Sometimes I have like a self-imposed pressure to watch movies because I want to know all there is to know about movies. And so I always feel like if I have a couple hours, I should be watching a movie. And sometimes I watch nothing because I'm like, it's too late to start a movie and I don't want to play a video game. So I just end up doing nothing. And I want to start using that time to dive into series, because that's the beauty of series, is you don't have to watch them all at once. I know a lot of people do, but I sometimes like the idea of like coming back and forth. I did it a few years ago. I did it with Psych. Like I would just kind of casually watch Psych, and I just did that with Central Park. I just finished that series. I'm keeping up with Last of Us, but I like that. I know each Sunday night I got to watch this, right? You know, like I have time to decompress afterwards, and yes. I want to do that with Andor. Like I have 12 episodes to watch, but I don't have any. If it was going to get spoiled for me, it would have already been spoiled. You know what I'm saying? Like no one's really talking about it now, and I somehow avoided the big spoilers. So like, I'm going to take my time with this. I'm not saying I'm going to wait like weeks. I'm still going to kind of, at least once a week, I'm going to try to watch an episode, maybe twice a week, but that's kind of my goal. And I have this list. I jump back on Serialized, which is like Letterboxd, Burke Reviews there as well. But for TV, I don't use it as much because, again, I don't watch a lot of TV, but I made my list on there and I have some goals. And so Andor was the number one series on that list because I have so many people just telling me, you got to watch Andor, you got to watch Andor, you got to watch Andor. So I was like, all right, Last of Us was my pick. I wanted to be on. I don't want that one to get spoiled because that's a series I really am passionate about. Andor, I want to jump in. And because so many people have said it's great. So I'm staying true so far. I haven't watched a lot of series in January, but I've watched more TV this month than I did most of last year. So, outside of the Marvel stuff, with that caveat, I don't know if I feel compelled to watch all the Marvel stuff this year. I might, but okay. Like I'm more, it feels like an obligation at this point. And I don't like that, Marvel. I don't like that I feel that way, because I've been one of your last, I think, film critics who are still like, what is everyone talking about?
Yes.
And I'm kind of like, I want to see Ant-Man because I like Ant-Man and I like Paul Rudd a lot. But you know, honestly, though, to be fair to the movies, it's not even the movies and shows that I'm tired of. It's all of the discourse I'm tired of. I'm tired of having to talk about it and everyone talking about it all the time. It's just like, I want to talk about almost anything else at this point.
I hear that, my friend. In terms of the TV series of Marvel, and I am also going to throw in things like the Book of Boba Fett and Obi-Wan Kenobi, that the Marvel series, that they're good series. You know, they're fun. But what I found as someone who doesn't really watch television, that when I watch something like so well made as The Last of Us, and I mean in every aspect, not just the story, and to an extent Andor as well, because this whole thing's practical. They put budget and time into that. I'm gravitating more to them now because they feel a bit less fluffy. They feel more substantial, and that isn't to say the Marvel the series are a bubblegum. Same for those Star Wars ones. But so I look at other examples of TV where they just do it better. You know, every aspect is done better, generally with smaller budgets as well sometimes. And I can't, and that also sometimes turns me off when I think the next Marvel series, hey, look, it might be fun, but the way it looks or certain things about it, or like the fact that it's only half an hour long when I can watch a really brilliant piece of TV, which is an hour long, and I can feel an awful lot more. Andor didn't give me that, though. I felt differently. But the films, though, you know, I'm kind of with you, but I'm not at the same time. Like, the Marvel films, I'll always be there to go and watch. I know you're the bigger fan.
Yeah.
I mean, Ant-Man, I enjoyed Ant-Man and the Wasp, sorry. Obviously, I'm extremely excited to see Ant-Man Quantumania for Jonathan Majors, just simply for him, because he is great. Obviously, Bill Murray's in it, and the trailers do look good, and it is setting up now the Kang dynasty. But I get you to a point there, though, my friend, yeah.
I think that's the part that makes me feel the fatigue, though, is the fact that I know it's setting up a lot of other stuff. And I'm like, I just want to see the movie. I just want to watch the movie and not have to worry about what's coming next. Like, you know,
those days are long gone, aren't they? It's mad.
I know they are. Even with like the new DC announcement, which look, it wasn't our news articles this week.
Oh,
even
yeah.
Though that's what dropped. But I wish it was just, these are movies we're making and not the universe we're building. You know, I already feel like I'm doing so much. I don't know how much
it's the
more
obligation,
I want to, like,
isn't it?
Yeah, it is. You know, but hey, I hope it's all great, mind you. I hope I'm like in a few months eating crow kind of thing. But
dude, if they smash it out of the park, then I'll be going back. I'll be lining up first in line. I know that with Star Wars, as far as I'm aware, they're going to be announcing a new film at Star Wars Celebration in April. Now, I think the idea will be, if the film does well, we'll release another one to bounce off it. My understanding is that they're not going to announce a series or a trilogy. It's going to be, here's a film, let's see how it does, which I'm all for.
I'm
because
for
it
that.
Could
Me
act
too.
As a standalone film, and they can bounce off if they want to. That, you know, a bit like Rogue One. I mean, that's kind of what I want to see more of.
Well, folks, that's our episode. As I alluded, we will be back next week to talk about M. Night Shyamalan's new film, Knock at the Cabin. I will say, I think it's pretty good.
Whoa.
With that said, you can follow us on social media. On Instagram, we're at Bloody Awesome Movie Pod. And on Twitter?
We are at BAMP_podcast, BAMP_podcast.
We're still on Facebook. You can search Bloody Awesome Movie Podcast. And pretty much anywhere that there's social media, we're probably there. Yeah. On individual sites, you can go to burkereviews.com to read all my reviews and follow me on social media at burkereviews. Matt, where can they find you?
whatiwatchtonight.co.uk, and similarly to JB, just search What I Watch Tonight across all of the socials, including Letterboxd, and you'll find me there.
And of course, we now contribute to the tomato meter, or the thermometer, tomato meter. I don't know how to say that.
Tomato meter.
The Rotten Tomatoes thing, where, you know, so like we said, Millennium Bugs, we're going to be giving you our fresh rating here soon.
Yes, sir.
But we ask that you do the same to us, listeners. If you like what we're doing, give us that rating, give us that fresh and or five star and or whatever weird rating system the device you're using to listen to us lets you do. It helps other shows or other listeners and shows find our show. And that's what this is all about. We're just a big podcast community. It's podcasters listening to other podcasters, breeding more podcasters, because what does this world need more of? Podcasts.
Podcasters.
With that, we encourage you to keep watching movies.
And stay bloody awesome. Awesome. Blood, 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 bloody, blood, 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 bloody.